Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
No one else gets these rewards.
Sergeant, that is just plain untrue.
What in tarnation?
Sir, PenFed's PowerCash Rewards Card isn't just for military members. Anyone can get cash back on all purchases.
Ah, figgins! You've ruined my favorite song.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/PowerCash. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Hey everybody, this is Keith Caulfield
and Katie Atkinson
of the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast, and you're listening to Billboard's Pop Shop Feed.
Because the Pop Shop family is growing, and now we've got new weekly shows in our Pop Shop feed in addition to the main Pop Shop podcast.
If you subscribe to the Pop Shop, you'll get not just the Pop Shop podcast, but also a show dedicated to reviewing the newest tunes, must-hear music, as well as a retro show that celebrates important anniversaries in music, Coming Around Again.
Today on the Coming Around Again anniversary podcast, Billboard.com senior associate editor Andrew Unterberger discusses a pair of classic albums turning 20, with Billboard senior contributor Gil Kaufman calling in to discuss Third Eye Blind's self-titled debut, and Billboard senior editor Joe Lynch stopping by to remember the Chemical Brothers' Dig Your Own Hole.
So be sure to subscribe to the Pop Shop feed in iTunes so you never miss any of our pop-centric shows. And give us a rating or review to let us know how much you're enjoying each segment of Pop Shop.
And now, Coming Around Again.
Hey, this is Andrew Unterberger, host of Coming Around Again, Billboard's new podcast celebrating notable musical anniversaries. On this pod, we'll be discussing one or two topics every Thursday related to albums, songs, bands, movies, or other music-themed items celebrating milestone birthdays, usually with other writers, but sometimes with the artists themselves. This week, I'm going to be talking about a couple records that I love. Both turned 20 last week, and that's Third Eye Blind's self-titled album and the Chemical Brothers' Dig Your Own Hole. I like the idea of pairing these two albums because together they kind of represent the opposing directions that alternative rock was being pulled in back in 1997. After the last bits of the grunge movement that defined the early decade basically died out. And at one poll, you had Dig Your Own Hole, which was really one of the iconic examples of the big beat dance sound that tried to push rock radio into the electronic age. The other poll, you had Third Eye Blind, which represented more of a kind of return to rock normalcy with loud guitars, anthemic choruses, and absolutely gigantic hooks. These albums met with varying levels of commercial and critical success at the time, but today I really think they both still sound fantastic. So I hope that you'll enjoy listening to me and a couple of my Billboard co-workers sharing our thoughts and memories of these two albums, and that you'll check back every Thursday to hear which of your other favorite artists and albums are coming around again. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Coming Around Again. My name is Andrew Unterberger. I'm a writer-editor for Billboard. This is our first podcast. We're going to be talking on Coming Around Again about Third Eye Blind's self-titled debut, which turned 20 last week. And on the other line, we have Gil Kaufman, senior contributor to Billboard, who wrote a really great oral history for us about the album. Gil, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So I really enjoyed reading this. I really enjoyed working on it with you. Anybody who hasn't read it yet really should check it out. You get to read about Third Eye Blind fighting with Oasis backstage. You get to see Stephen Jenkins talking with Linda Perry of Four Non Blondes before either of them were famous. And you get a bunch of really fun origin stories about some of the songs on the album. So before we get into the kind of the crux of the oral history, why don't you tell me about a little bit about your own history with Third Eye Blind? Now, in the late 90s, you were working at
Addicted to Noise, like an early music website that was actually down the street from where they were recording in San Francisco. Is that right?
Yeah, Addicted to Noise was a really early internet music magazine, kind of the first professional music webzine founded by a former Rolling Stone writer in about 1994, actually. So before anybody was really using the web commercially, and we happened to have an office. There were three of us when we started in the Mission in San Francisco, and it was literally down the street. I would get off at my subway stop, my BART stop, and I would pass Toast Studios, which is where Third Eye Blind did some of the sessions for that first album, as well as their second album, Blue. And after I did a couple stories about them for Addicted to Noise, I got to know Jenkins a little bit, and he would invite me to just drop by the studio and watch them record occasionally.
And do you remember what your first impressions were, either of Third Eye Blind as a band or of Jenkins just as a guy?
My first impressions are the impressions that lasted and remain after talking to him for this story. he's a unique individual in that I also lived in Chicago during the rise of the Smashing Pumpkins, and I got to see them quite a bit because I got to know Billy Corgan kind of early on, and I got to go to rehearsals and watch them perform, and they're similar in my mind because they're both really singular, driven musicians who have a vision and don't really let anybody or anything get in their way. And Jenkins, even at that time, the first time I met him, I went to the studio, and I seem to recall he probably spent about a half an hour just showing me his guitars, and he didn't really introduce me to the other guys. You know, I introduced myself, and you know, if you talk to anybody about Stephen Jenkins, one thing they will tell you about Stephen Jenkins is he is Third Eye Blind, and he firmly believes that. And I think what was interesting about the oral history is it kind of reinforces that idea that in his mind, everything is, you know, that is Third Eye Blind. It comes from him, and it's true in a lot of ways, and it's also the mythology that he's built up. So I got that almost instantly from meeting him, that idea that he is Third Eye Blind and everything that comes from Third Eye Blind springs from his brain.
And so, you know, while you're kind of witnessing him trying to, you know, push this vision out into the world, does it seem like it's something that, I mean, did it seem to you like it was going to be something that connected with people the way it did? Did the songs kind of jump out right away, or was it surprising when he kind of took over the world that year?
I remember listening to this album when it first came out, and you know, I think to this day, I just saw them last year, and I've heard Semi-Charmed Life probably 1,000 times, and that song is one of the most undeniable songs to come out of that era. I think it's just, you know, in talking to him about the story, he talked about the origin of it, and it took years and years for that to come together, and he was 32 when he broke through, and I think that there's something about, you know, those songs and the way they put them together that really do have a legacy. And there's a reason we're talking about it now, and people still listen to the songs. When I go to see them now, it's mostly 20-year-olds at the show. I don't know how they discover Third Eye Blind, but there's something about those songs that I think have really lasted. That album, especially that first album, that just has a legacy that is undeniable.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a couple years younger than you are, and when I was 11 is about when the band really broke out in 1997. And, you know, that for people who weren't necessarily around at the time or weren't, you know, super plugged into alt rock, like, you might look back on that year and sort of assume that, you know, the 1997 alt rock was kind of defined by, I don't know, like Radiohead or, you know, the big beat movement, the electronica movement that really tried to take hold there. But as somebody who lived through it, I can attest to the fact that this album was the sound of alternative rock in 1997. This album was everywhere, and I find it particularly interesting because, you know, the alt-rock scene in 1997 was kind of in a state of crisis because, you know, a lot of the original grunge bands, the Pearl Jams and Soundgardens, Alice in Chains, like, they'd either broken up or they'd sort of checked out of the mainstream rock landscape. They were doing their own thing, or they were doing separate things altogether. Even the post-grunge bands, the first wave, Live or Bush or bands like that, their moment kind of came and went in the couple years after that. And then in 1997, there was kind of this void, and nobody really knew what was going to happen next. And, you know, there were a couple, you know, the rock radio kind of dabbled in ska for a minute, they dabbled in big beat, but I think that the album that kind of forecast where rock was going next was the Third Eye Blind self-titled album. Does that jibe with your memory at the time?
Yeah, for sure. And my favorite part about doing the story, and I suspect Jenkins wouldn't love it if I said it, but there was a moment where I made an attempt to describe exactly what you're saying. I mean, mm-hmm. you had the you know, secondary grunge wave that was kind of washing out, and then Britney and NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, that was bubbling up, and so you had this kind of clash between harder rock and bubblegum pop and the kind of dirty lyrical and musical aspect of bands like Bush and Alice in Chains, and then the super sugary stuff. And the way I described it and trying to posit it to Jenkins was he found this sweet spot in between where it was super catchy music and it really had this kind of uplifting, you know, feel to it. But when you spent even a cursory, you know, took a cursory glance at the lyrics, they were super dark and really kind of sad and twisted. And he covered them in this sheen that was just so catchy. And so he was this perfect bridge. And, you know, for a guy who'd been striving since his teenage years to try to break through and didn't make it until a pretty advanced age in music, 32, he just hit this window that was kind of incredible, you know. He'd been working on Semi-Charmed Life for about 4 years, or 5 years almost, and he was this weird bridge between grunge and big beat and the pop revolution, and I think that album just came at, like, the perfect moment. It was really kind of incredible, and he really did capture a moment there that I think helped kind of foresee what happened after and really made sense of that whole era.
Yeah, and I think one of the best quotes that you got in your piece, and I'm not sure if you said it before, but, you know, he was talking about Semi-Charmed Life, and he called the song basically his Walk on the Wild Side, referring back to the old Lou Reed song. I think you hear that, and you kind of, like, you know, you roll your eyes a little bit reflexively, like, you know, who's this guy think he is, like, you know, comparing himself to Lou Reed. If you look at the song, it's actually not that bad a comparison. You know, the hook, you know, the doot-doot-doot hook is very kind of comparable to the similar one in Walk on the Wild Side.
And that's not unintentional. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, sure.
There's nothing he did, and in talking to him over the years, very little is left to chance in what he does. I think he thinks and overthinks things a lot, and that is a total callback to that song. He has as much said it when I talk to him, and I think, you know, between the lyrics about crystal meth and just all the kind of, you know, lyrical allusions to things you don't hear on pop radio, you know, especially at that point, I think it's really an apt allusion to that song.
And that's probably true, and I'm sure that's what he hears when he hears the song. I think if you're listening to the song on radio in 1997, you probably think of it the same way you think of Hanson's Mbop, you know, the same kind of onomatopoeic hook.
Totally.
That, you know, you don't necessarily, I mean, it takes a lot of listens to the verses of Semi-Charmed Life before you really pick up on the kind of underbelly of the song. But the do-do-do part, that pops immediately. And I think that kind of gets at the core dilemma that you kind of brace when dealing with Stephen Jenkins and Third Eye Blind, which is that this guy's perception of himself and his music and his place in the rock universe is totally different than the way he's perceived by anybody else. So but before we started talking on the show, I kind of gave you a homework assignment, and I asked you to come up with a way to fill in the blank to this sentence, which is Stephen Jenkins is the 90s version of blank, but he thinks he's the 90s version of blank. And did you come up with good names for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he thinks he's the Prince / Lenny Kravitz
of
the 90s, you know, in that he thinks he's a guy who plays a lot, you know, he plays drums, he plays guitar, he plays bass, he writes lyrics, he writes melodies, he produces. He's a one-man band, but really, he's kind of the Billy Corgan of the 90s, in that he's got great ideas. You know, Billy Corgan was a Billy Corgan in the 90s, too. But he's got
Cole
great
Corgan's
ideas.
In the 90s, yeah.
He's super talented. He's a great musician. But nobody, you know, except for Prince and Lenny Kravitz, to a degree, works in a vacuum. And I think what was interesting to me about the story was the Rashomon tale of this album, right?
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
If you hear, you know, him tell it, everything on this album, he is as much says to me, there is not a single lyric or lyrical idea on this album that didn't come from me. But almost everybody else who I talked to had a different story about that. So I think he thinks of himself as this one-man band whose vision is Third Eye Blind, but I think he's more akin to somebody who has a great vision but really does need that great supporting cast to get it done, which Billy Corgan had as well. I mean, James Iha, I saw the Pumpkins probably 50 times in their heyday, and you can't tell me that, you know, Billy Corgan couldn't have done what he did without Jimmy Chamberlain's incredible drumming and James Iha's, you know, rhythm guitar and some leads that he, you know, occasionally got to slip in, you know, or even Darcy. So I think, in talking to Eric Valentine, the co-producer of this album, he would talk about, in this really, really visceral way, about all the things that the other guys did, you know, Kevin the guitarist, how he brought this shoegaze aspect to the record, and Orion the bassist, who was playing 8-string basses and triple and quadruple, you know, tracking bass parts, and the drummer Brad, and, you know, just all these elements that were so vital to the album that made up the album that, you know, Steven will tell you is his entire vision. So I think if I were to answer that question, that's what it would be. You know, he thinks he's friends, but he's really more like Billy.
And it's interesting to hear you bring up Kevin Cadogan, or Cadogan, I'm always going to pronounce that name wrong.
Yeah.
But he kind of played a bigger part in the story than I was expecting. And I was surprised, you know, an adjective that you mentioned yourself and that a number of people in your story used to describe his kind of guitar playing and tone is shoegazy. And that's a strange word, I think, to hear connected with Third Eye Blind, when most people, you know, 90s rock nerds that even know what shoegaze is in the first place, when they hear that word, they think, you know, wall of sound guitars, they think My Bloody Valentine and Ride and a bunch of bands that we're more on the indie side of things and definitely nowhere near the commercial stratosphere of Third Eye Blind. So it made me wonder, like, is this guy kind of the secret weapon of Third Eye Blind? Is he like, you know, the John Cale of the group, to go back to the Lou Reed metaphor? Is he the guy that kind of gave them that, I don't know, that musical edge, that artistic credibility that they lost because after he left after the second album?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, he would tell you that, and Orion said it, and Eric said it. I think what's funny is I hadn't listened to the full album probably in 10 or 15 years, and I went back and listened to it probably, you know, 10 or 15 times in writing the story, and I was blown away by the nuance and the kind of depth of his playing, you know, as well as Orion's bass playing and the drumming. I mean, it's a much more musical album than I remember it being, and the parts, now that I've heard them talk about it and heard them describe it, are so much more distinct in my mind, and I was looking for it, obviously, but the way that he plays on this album is really subtle, and it's pretty beautiful at parts. I mean, there's parts where he really does, you can tell, if you listen to it with the right ear, that he is going for that Kevin Shields kind of My Bloody Valentine thing, and it's not, you know, it's not aping it, it's not, he's not ripping anybody off, but he definitely has a sound that is super unique to this album and this era, I think.
Yeah, and so it makes me wonder, you know, what was it about Stephen Jenkins that ended up being so untenable to have this other guy in the band kind of co-leading their artistic vision? Is this guy just a narcissist, do you think?
You know, I go back to this quote, right? So it's in the story, and I asked Stephen, I said, what changed when Kevin and Orion joined the band? Or, you know, did anything change when they joined the band? And his response was very, very curt, and it was no, not really. And I think that kind of tells you a little bit about this band. If you look at the history of it, there's a series of lawsuits over credits, over, you know, royalties between the manager and a couple of the previous band members. Kevin and Ryan were both pretty hands-off about it, but I think they made it clear in talking to me that it was a difficult situation. I mean, Steven is a kind of guy, and again, I used the Billy Corgan illusion. I saw, when the Pumpkins played this show in this tiny, tiny club in Madison, Wisconsin, when they were recording the Siamese Dream there, it was probably a 100-person club, and they were just playing those songs for the first time, or one of the first times, at the end of the show, Billy wanted to keep playing, but James didn't. And I saw them get in a fight in the back alley. And at some point, it looked like Billy literally kicked James in the butt, you know, because he was so mad that he wouldn't come back out and play more songs. And I think that's kind of the Third Eye Blind is one of those things where the ego of the leader was so big that it was hard to find a space for yourself in the band. You know, I think at one point Eric said to me that you know, he was really proud of having worked on this record, but he didn't see any way that it could sustain itself as a band just because of the way things were, you know, in the personal realm. It was too hard for them to keep it together because of the clash of personalities. And it was a bummer. I mean, at one point he handed over a recording of this album. He had this studio he told me about. It was called Hunk of Shit Studios in Redwood City. And he, you know, let them come in and record there. And he handed it over to this guy, Jason Slater, who worked with him. And he was just like, I'm going to let you do this. And at some point, Jason came to him and said, hey, man, I need you to finish this record. I can't get it done. And, you know, and he said, all right, well, I'll help you out. And he goes, you know, I'll just take over, actually. And Jason was like, awesome. You know, like, yeah. He's like, yes, please. You know, he's like, dude, I'm out of here. You know, so I think there's a magic that is caught on albums like this. And you look at any of those bands from that era, Oasis, you know, to a lesser degree, because they were able to stretch it out over a couple albums. There's a magic that you catch with these kind of bands, and when you have a strong personality like that, sometimes it only lasts one album or two albums. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's enough. You know, sometimes that's all you need. You only need those one or two albums. And I think in the case of Third Eye Blind, it was just too volatile, and I think, you know, they managed to make, I think Blue is also a pretty decent album, you know, a good album, but they couldn't keep that together. And if you look at the timeline of this band, there's been a number of people in it, and I think that's a testament to the fact that it's a difficult row to hoe, you know, if you're in there with Steven.
For sure. But the interesting thing to me about all this, you know, as we're talking about kind of Steven's, you know, megalomania, or maybe just kind of like the fact that, you know, through all this, I would say probably that their second best known song, the second biggest single off this album, is an incredibly empathetic song in Jumper, which is, you know, kind of their, it's Steven saying to I think based on a true story, as you kind of relate in your piece, about him saying to somebody who's going through a really tough time, like, hey, you don't have to go through this. And if you know, even just talking to me about this makes it too painful for me to be in your life, then I'd understand if you didn't want to see me again. And that's an incredibly sort of giving sentiment. It's an incredibly selfless sentiment, which makes for an interesting juxtaposition with what we know about him as a creative figure.
Yeah, no, I think that story, when he told me that story, and I've heard it before, but it really, you know, he said really beautiful things about how, you know, when you make yourself vulnerable by putting yourself out there to help somebody, sometimes it's so raw that they can't look at you anymore. You know, and in this case, it was a woman who had been sexually assaulted, and she needed money to take care of some medical things, and she couldn't go to her parents, and so, you know, she gave so much of herself to him and telling her, you know, him her story, that it was too painful to even interact with him anymore. And he was like, you know what, I get it. And he took that really difficult situation and he turned it into a song, and it's a really beautiful song. I mean, go back and listen to the lyrics, and you really, now that you know the story, it's an incredible song. And I think he was able to capture a sentiment in that song and an emotion that really points to his gift as a songwriter. I think he does have an ability to be empathetic, but it comes with this kind of other side of him that makes it difficult for him to empathize sometimes with the people he works with.
All true. And so would you say that doing this oral history, has it made you like the band more? Has it made you like them less? So what, does it affect your opinion of the album at all?
It makes me a lot more interested. You know, like I said, it made me more interested in going back and listening to it and really digging into it a little bit more. I don't think anything about the interviews I did, including with, you know, Sylvia Roan, the legendary music figure who signed the band, and who said that she was blown away by Jenkins and the band, and thought they sounded beautiful. He looked like a rock star. she was immediately sold, you know, without knowing anything about them, when she saw them play at the Viper Room at a showcase with, like, you know, pretty much every other major label there. You know, none of that changed my thought about the band. I like I said, I've seen them a bunch of times, including over the last couple of years, and when you hear these songs, they're just undeniable, and I think it kind of cemented in my mind that these guys captured some magic that, you know, like What's the Story, Morning Glory, or Siamese Dream, you know, or any of those landmark albums from that time really, really, you know, deserves a spot in the rock pantheon. And, you know, some people think this is kind of a slight band and that they are too poppy, and that's something that Jenkins gave me a 20-minute dissertation on why I was wrong about that.
Don't doubt it.
But, you know, no, it didn't change my mind about them, and it made me like them a little bit more, because I really did learn that this was a pretty incredible partnership that couldn't last, but as long as it did, they were able to do something that really stands the test of time. I mean, I think one of the testaments to this is when I posted on Facebook a link to the story, I was blown away by the amount of people who hit me up on Facebook and kind of on the side and said, shit, I love this album, Black, White, you know, like every kind of friend of mine was like, yeah, man, I love this album. I was just listening to this, or yeah, I forgot how much I love this album. And these are people who range from their, you know, late 20s to mid 40s. And they all have had that same, oh yeah, reaction to it that you don't get with every album. There's something about this that really affects people in a way that's kind of ineffable, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that separates it in a not-so-good way from those other albums you mentioned, the Siamese Dreams and whatnot, is that, you know, you should have saved some of those singles for the second side of the album, because it's just, you know, the first six tracks, the five singles and Narcolepsy, which might be the best album track on the album.
Yeah.
And it's hard to maintain that for another eight tracks afterwards. But you're right, that the singles hold up about as well as anything from that era. It's a more musically and thematically complex album that I think a lot of people probably remember. And I've enjoyed digging back into it over these last couple of weeks as you've been working on this story. So yeah,
for sure.
So thank you so much, Gil, for coming on, man. This has been great. And if you haven't read it yet, you really got to check out Gil Kaufman's Oral History of the First Third Eye Blind album. It's on Billboard. It's a great story.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hey, and welcome back to Coming Around Again. We're going to be talking next about the 20th anniversary of the Chemical Brothers' Big Beat masterpiece, Dig Your Own Hole, turned 20 late last week. And here to discuss it with us is Billboard senior editor Joe Lynch. What's up, Joe?
Hey, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Excited to be here to talk Chemical Brothers.
Well, I wanted to have you on because we were talking about this album a couple weeks ago, and you mentioned that you, as all young men do at some point in their life, went through a very big beat phase back in the day. So,
big beat phase.
So why don't you tell me about that for a minute?
I don't know if I want to oversell it too much. I mean, this was definitely the era. Let me set the scene. It's the late 90s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Music was something one had to pay for. And
heard of that.
Therefore, you know, there was not a YouTube or a Spotify where you could just easily, readily sample things. So if something wasn't on the radio, you pretty much had to go out and buy the album. So I would say I was a fan, but because it was something I liked a lot when I was that age, my knowledge is certainly not extensive. It's very much limited to the albums that I went out to buy.
And can you name some of those for the readers at home who might be
unfamiliar? I was very, very, this was one of them, Chemical Brothers, Dig Your Own Hole. I loved Chemical Brothers, Exit Planet Dust was one of my favorite albums to drive around listening to. Fatboy Slim's albums, I like The Prodigy. And then the rest was all kind of stuff that I just heard, you know, like, I don't know, Crystal Method or whatever through mm-hmm. friends. And I was never super into that. Either a lot of the other ones.
The second tier.
Yeah, the kind of second tier associated with it I never glommed onto as much, maybe because I didn't have the album, or maybe just because it wasn't my sort of thing. But Chemical Brothers, I would say, you know, I really loved when I was in high school. Didn't listen to for a long time after that, and then kind of when this electronic renaissance, like when EDM became a term that people started using
sure.
again, I remembered it, and I started working out while listening to it, and I was like, this music is just so, like, it's just so... there's always just so much forward motion in it, and it's just very, like, joyous music. It's really fun. It's, you know, even when it's, like, being weird and has kind of uncomfortable sounds in it, it's just really fun music.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that, and certainly at the time, you know, I was a young teenager at the time, and I certainly had no knowledge of the history of electronic dance music, Chicago or Detroit stuff. Obviously, I didn't find about until much, much later. So this was kind of the year zero of dance music, as far as I was concerned.
Totally, yeah. As far as I was concerned, I mean, I knew I had, I think, the Aphex Twin ambient sound CD, and so I was aware that there was like kind of a
as a 10-year-old.
Not as a 10-year-old. Okay. No, I would have been like. And I didn't have this album when it came out, I should say. Okay, I had it a couple enough. Years out later, right. Mid-high school. So I was aware that there was kind of this underground background. But yeah, as far as I was concerned, dance music was this European thing, and Americans didn't listen to it. It occasionally made an appearance on MTV. But my parents didn't even have cable. So like this was all very like otherworldly for me. But I think, this album, like it's just... I know a lot of people think it's their best. Personally, I skew Exit Planet Dust. I think that's probably because it was the first one I bought. But it's just like, it's just so beautiful. Like, I'd say my favorite, and probably an obvious one, but Where Do I Begin, right, which is right. The second to last song on the album. It has a very kind of like beautiful electro folk intro from Beth Orton. And then it just like, you know, builds up to a very climactic big beat thing. Gets like totally deconstructed towards the end. There's this like sound of like angry kitchen appliances, like screaming. Like, it's just weird. That's one thing when I was re-listening to this album, I love that a lot of their songs have these strange codas. Like Electro Bank has a weird ending. The Get Up On It Like This has kind of like it takes the vocal and like chops it up and repeats it over and over almost to like an annoying point where it kind of sounds like cats yowling. Like there's just like a very, they do a, like every song, maybe not every song, but many of the songs like end in a strange way that mm-hmm. I found very compelling.
Well, I certainly have my favorites on this album too, and I'll talk about them in a second. But I think the thing that I like about this album the most, this is one of my, 10, 20 favorite albums of all time. They've been a major fixture for 20 years now. I think I bought it close to when it came out. I was very taken with the music videos, and this was sort of my entry to that world. This and a couple other albums from that year. But the thing about the album that struck me when I first really got into it and continues to strike me now is that it's seamless. Mm-hmm. I think 11 or 12 tracks, and it's basically continuous from one song to the next. There's very few hard gaps. There's very few obvious breaks in between the tracks, and as you say, they're kind of these outro coda things that work as sort of interstitial, like stitching in between the songs.
Yeah,
and that is something that like I really miss in terms of electronic albums, and that you don't really see. When Calvin Harris puts out an album, when Zedd puts out an album, dudes like that, basically singles compilations. They're glorified. Right. It's like, okay, here's one song, here's the next song, here's the song after that.
Yeah.
And this album, it's like listening to a really awesome DJ set. It's like mm-hmm. just kind of being taken, forgive the cliche, but being taken on a journey. It really is.
I forgive that.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that. And it's a 1 hour listening experience. And I don't think you can really, you can separate the songs and radio try to, but it's much, much richer to listen to altogether.
Yeah.
And I asked our senior dance editor, Matt Medved, if he thought that was something that might ever come back in dance music. And he says, well, we might get a little bit more of that as sort of the live DJ set experience turns into just a live performance mm-hmm. for dance music. And I guess people get tired of just the DJ sets and they want to hear that next level. And he says, Porter Robinson might do stuff like that some days. But he brings up, and I sort of agree, that the streaming era makes that very difficult now, where like you get these release schedules where you get five or six songs ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
like the Chainsmokers album that's going to be number one this week. We've already heard several songs from, and you can't. They're very individually packaged and for individual sale on iTunes even.
Yes,
and so you don't really get that anymore.
I think that's a very good point. Also, it's also the playlist era. Like people don't listen to albums as much. They kind of stitch together favorite songs. So that makes it less likely that an artist is going to want a track that like ends unexpectedly and abruptly. I do think it's too bad, though. I mean, yeah, it like really, I think that kind of like seamless thing really is a throwback to the disco era when they would take actual singles and then like, DJ stitch them together and make it so it did seem kind of like a seamless experience. And there is a lot of disco on this. Like, It Doesn't Matter might be my other favorite song on the album. And that one, you know, has that great, like, disco hi-hat thing going throughout.
I remember there was some publication, I can't remember, some UK dance publication that did, like, a list of the 100 greatest dance songs of all time. And they had, I think It Doesn't Matter, it was, like, in their top 10.
Wow.
And like, most of it was, like, very, like, old school disco kind of Sylvester type stuff, but they made an exception for this one deep cut on the Chemical Brothers album that definitely made me hear it in a new way.
That's awesome.
But my personal favorite song on the album is kind of a predictable choice, which is Setting Sun, which was the lead single off the album, featured Noel Gallagher of Oasis on vocals, had a great video that they played a lot, and to me this song is still an absolute mind warp. You know, they kind of swiped the drum part from The Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows, and I know you're a big Beatles fan as well.
Never heard of them. But, no. I love...
You found out about them through the Chemical Brothers, as most people our age did. Yeah, sure.
I always wondered, I have no idea, but like it seems a little cheeky, and they are British, so they would be cheeky, but to like take a very Beatles-esque song, kind of has that like Middle Eastern Tomorrow Never Knows thing, and then give it to Noel Gallagher. You know, Oasis were obviously accused of like being a little too close to comfort for the Beatles, so I wonder if that was like a little bit of a playful sort of thing with them.
Yeah, maybe. And you know, Noel Gallagher has obviously never had any problem leaning into his cartoonish fixation with the past.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Out of curiosity, have you ever heard the Oasis demo version of Setting Sun? I think it came
out. I've not. No.
It came out, I think, on the Be Here Now 20th year anniversary, and that's a
no
another discussion
I
for another time. But yeah. That's. It's very interesting because it's in the Oasis version, it is kind of a verse chorus sort of song, and it kind of follows a sort of predictable chord structure, and it's a good melody, but it's not necessarily like a particularly great melody. But in the hands of the Chemical Brothers, you know, they warp it, they kind of stretch it out like taffy, and then they drop this incredible like atom bomb break right in the middle of it, and then come back, and it's, you know, explosions everywhere,
right?
And it's unbelievable. You know, you talked about this already, but just how propulsive the music is. You know, the drums never stop, and I've never tried it as a workout music, but now I think I might have to.
I think it's a good one. I mean, yeah, and I agree with what you're saying. There is a little kind of what we're saying with the propulsive thing. Like, you do, when you lose that, there's something a little bit sad about losing that in culture, like an hour-long mix. You know, and obviously people make kind of like mixes of other people's songs, but kind of a seamless album of dance music that just goes from one thing to the next. I would not be mad if I saw that come back.
No.
I mean, and this is certainly not recent, but not to bring it back to Madonna, but I'm going to find a way to.
Always comes back to Madonna.
But she had the Confessions on a Dance Floor album, which was her disco throwback. And she released two versions of it, one of which was separate tracks, and then the other was kind of like a seamless mix where everything like kind of did like one track into the other. So, I mean, maybe someone could do something like that. Yeah. I don't know.
Get Madonna and the Chemical Brothers together.
That would have been incredible.
Yeah. We were talking about this before, and you said that, you know, it's been a little while since you had listened to the album, but you're gonna give it another shot in preparation for the podcast. So I'm curious, did any aspects of the album stick out as particularly dated to you? Is there anything that you're like, maybe that hasn't aged so well?
You know, oddly enough, not really. I mean, the only thing I would say is... almost the opposite. I would say when it came out, again, I didn't get it in 1997 when it came out. I probably bought it in like 2000 or something. I kind of thought Block, Rock, and Beats was a little lame. I wasn't super into it. It just seemed like a not totally convincing attempt at hip hop. But listening to it now, it actually sounds, for some reason, I guess I'm giving it more of a pass. I enjoyed it a lot more. I think kind of bereft of any historical context, it makes a little more sense. At the time, I was just like, oh, American rap is like so much further ahead of this. Like, what are, like, they sound like way behind
the time.
Of
Chemical Brothers.
But now, just in a kind of general sense where it just kind of like floats in this ether of classic recordings, it sounded good to me. So really very little of it seemed, I mean, the only thing that stood out, and this isn't so much dated, but it struck me, and I guess this is probably why, you know, rock people liked the Chemical Brothers so much, is that there is so much guitar in this, which you don't get in modern dance music. Electro Bank has like a kind of a psychedelic fuzz breakdown at the end. You know, the bass line is very prominent. Obviously, that's not unnatural for dance music. But, you know, there's a lot of guitar noises in this that you just really don't get in contemporary dance music, or even really in a lot of their contemporaries. I mean, Fatboy Slim wasn't very guitar heavy, maybe bassline, but not otherwise.
Well, this brings me to my next very important question, which is, have you ever actually tried dancing to the Chemical Brothers?
That is an excellent question, and I think the answer is no. Okay, I mean, I feel like I've never been at a party where they've come on, unless I'm forgetting something.
But well, no, I asked because, you know, obviously I was not, I was too young, as I imagine you were as well, to be kind of part of the original rave movement. Not that
right.
Chemical Brothers even necessarily had much to do with that, but the only time that I've ever actually danced in the Chemical Brothers was I was at a friend's wedding, and, you know, his friend was basically the DJ, so he got to call the shots on the playlist. And they played Block, Rock, and Beats, which was a big song mm-hmm. for me and some of my friends growing up. And we had no idea what to do with this song. It's actually a very slow song that just happens to have a very fast bass line.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to it now, you know, for how propulsive the album is, which we talked about a bunch already, like, I don't know how you dance to this album. The rhythms are kind of counterintuitive. And it's more just like full body, like almost like the old school like electronic body music than actual like house 4/4 beats that you can actually like pump your fist to or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of maybe like head bobbing music. I think when I was listening to it earlier today with my headphones on, my head was definitely going up and down pretty furiously. But no, you're right. I it's hard to imagine like how you would move your legs to this, legs and shoulders. Like what are they doing?
It's not happening, and it does. Make me wonder, like how this album really resonates with people younger than us, who are you know, they're used to dance music being like an inextricable part of the mainstream, and you know, for them, it's not mind blowing at all to hear, you know, a DJ duo or mm-hmm. an electronic based act be, you know, the headliner at a major rock festival or anything like that. And I do sort of wonder, like, if I was trying to talk to somebody, you know, 15 years younger than me about the Chemical Brothers, would I sound like a classic rockhead, like raving about Foghat or something? Like, is it just totally out of step at this point?
I would say probably, but I mean, maybe Foghat may be a little harsh.
Okay.
Hope no one's in Foghat's listening to this, but I mean, you know, they might not be quite that like lame, but yeah, it might be like a totally separate world for them. I feel like, and I could be wrong, but I feel like people who, and you kind of, we talked about this pre-podcast a little bit, that I think just without having personalities, you know, not to say they don't have personalities, but that was not part of their look. Someone like Moby or Tiesto maybe seems slightly more relevant to a younger audience, whereas like Chemical Brothers, like no one knows anything about them. They maybe have faded off a bit more, but I could be 100% wrong. Like maybe people who love you know, like teenagers who love electronic music, like this is part of their curriculum. Mm-hmm. I can't really say for sure.
Yeah, no, I you know, this is obviously something that proved to be a major stumbling block for the Chemical Brothers, because, you know, they didn't really know how to present themselves in any interesting way. And if I went back and I read a couple like contemporary profiles of the Chemical Brothers, you know, in preparation for this, and basically the writers all have to kind of deal with the essential question, which is how do we make these guys seem interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And they have no interest in seeming interesting themselves. And you know, when you compare that to like, you know, Daft Punk, who had a very defined aesthetic with the robot helmets and all that. And the Prodigy, who had like this incredibly charismatic frontman and Keith Flint, who actually didn't even really do that much in mm-hmm. the group, but they were able to kind of put him at the forefront of their videos, and it made them seem visually exciting. The Chemical Brothers, they lived and died by the strength of their music videos, and they had some really good ones. They had some really clever ones. They had some really imaginative, eye-catching ones. They got the best acting performance of Sofia Coppola's career in the Electro Bank video. Have you ever seen that one?
Well, like I said, I didn't have MTV growing up, so I don't actually think I've seen that.
Yeah, she plays like a gymnast doing kind of one like final routine, and like there's an evil gymnast sitting on the other sides, and she's got like a Belly Caroli type figure kind of coaching her on. Her parents show up at the last second. It's a great video, and it's a fantastic Sofia Coppola performance.
I'll have to check it out.
But yeah, the fact that, you know, we're talking about Sofia Coppola as an important part of the Chemical Brothers image shows just, you know, kind of how bereft they were of their own charisma.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me actually of a similar act, Basement Jacks, who mm-hmm. kind of the same fate befell them. I mean, like a great album act who I feel like are not super well known or talked about these days, at least among kids.
Sure.
You know, I think they're very well liked among people who grew up listening to them, but compared to, you know, like we said, like a Fatboy Slim or maybe a Tiesto, who like the kids, I feel like I'm not really that old, but you know, like who like teenagers are aware of still.
Young compared to us, certainly.
Yes. Not so much the case. with Chemical Brothers. Mm-hmm. They did have, I mean, I guess they must be well-known enough that, like, Lord tapped them. Everyone's favorite cool, no longer a teen, but Lord tapped them for that Hunger Games soundtrack.
I forgot about that. That's a good point.
Which
yeah.
was, I think, like a Miguel collaboration or right. something. That was a very cool song.
That song was very cool, and it ended up on their album, but without Miguel on it, which was a bummer to me personally. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. And again, when I was talking with Matt earlier, he mentioned that there are a couple kind of next-gen electronic musicians that are starting to weave Chemical Brothers samples into their mm-hmm. stuff and you know, kind of recognizing the legacy there. But yeah, I think that the true legacy of the Chemical Brothers is just that they made really great albums. And I don't know how well they hold up in the current EDM landscape or how much relevance they have with artists today or the people that listen to them. But, you know, you go back and listen to these albums, they still sound fantastic. And I'd say of the, if you want to talk about the kind of the three big electronic albums from 97, they'd probably be The Prodigy's Fat of the Land, Daft Punk's Homework, and Dig Your Own Hole. And, you know, Fat of the Land was the most popular at the time. You know, it debuted number one in the US charts. And Homework is probably the one that holds up the best. You know, it's the one that the most people still listen to.
So, yeah.
But I think Dig Your Own Hole is the best of these three albums. And
I would believe that as well. Okay. I think I'm a Daft Punk fan, but yeah, I think their acclaimed albums can run a little long, and I think there's very little fat on this.
For sure. Less fat than the Fat of the Land.
Less fat than Fat of the Land, definitely.
All right, well, that seems as good a note as any to end on. Thanks for coming on, Joe. Appreciate you talking Chemical Brothers with me. And hopefully this reignites your big beat phase. Maybe get a nice volume 2 in there.
I'm going to go home and try to dance to this.
All right.
That's what I'm going to do.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.